Energy and Environment. 5 o'clock p.m. Hearing Room 343. Hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 237. Tapes number 98 and 99.
I expect some other members at some point to get the This is our second hearing on the Land Use Bill 237, and Monday we dealt with the marginal lands portion of the bill, and tonight we're trying to have people focus their testimony as much as possible on the EFU portions, which deal with the accepted uses of EFU land and the changes that that this bill proposes to make. I'd like to call first, let's see, I think I'll have Hector McPherson and Lois Kennedy come up.
For the record, I am Hector McPherson, a farmer from Linn County and member of Ag for Oregon. And this is the Hector and Lois part of the show tonight. Lois?
Lois Kennedy from Benton County, Corvallis, Oregon, strawberry farmer there. For the information of other people in the audience, I have laid over in a chair there copies of a six-page explanatory statement on the bill that we had made available to committee members earlier. But since the bill is fairly lengthy and complicated, I thought it might be helpful for other people, and they're there if they wish to keep them, to pick them up.
We wanted to take the committee, and unfortunately we don't have much committee to take through some changes.
Yeah,
in
I'm
the
sorry
bill.
About that.
But if we put it in here, we'll get to them privately, and surely the word will get back to them that we are making some changes from the printed bill. Some of these changes are ones that were suggested at the time that we first presented it, but were not in writing, and therefore were not included in the engrossed copy of Senate Bill 237. I'll run through those first before we go into the philosophies involved in what we're trying to do. But before I say anything else, I simply would like to point out to those of you who are here that we in Ag for Oregon think this really is the heart of what we're trying to do in the changes in the exclusive farm use zone, because here is where we look at the dwelling problem, the non-farm dwelling, the farm dwelling problem, and the parcelization of good farmland. So this part is critical. We have a couple of other things that come in this section of the bill, but this is a section that we consider most important, besides the marginal land conception that we presented the last time. Now, we are proposing several changes, and so I'll take you through the changes that we're proposing, and I'm going to read them since there are people in the audience that won't have access to what we're doing. We, of course, are in the section of 215, 213, a part of the bill, which is on page 5. But let me point out that there are a number of changes in this part of the bill which do not come from Ag from Oregon. And as I understand it, the interim committee people will be here tonight. In fact, I understand Dick Benner will present those to you. So I will not say anything about those changes, which did not come from Ag for Oregon, which is the first one. One's on lines 31 through 33. Down at the bottom of the page on line 38, we have the life estate, which is not one of the biggies that we were suggesting, but we do have a small change there that was presented before. We think that for an educational purpose primarily, we should point out that life estates are one way to go when you have a farmer that retires in an exclusive farm use zone and wants to continue to live on his land. He can be granted a life estate for that portion which surrounds these buildings, and therefore he does not have to move off, but that does not become separated from the rest of the land. So our change was simply to delete that part of the language which is in the printed bill, which is not to exceed blank acres, because we saw there was no purpose.
So
in
you're
that.
Deleting, you're, on line 38, you're deleting not to exceed blank acres.
Yes, and I...
The rationale on that is that we assume that the farmer purchaser and the farmer seller we'll be able to make a wise decision of whether that's a half acre or 2 or 3 acres or whatever, and that does not need to be stated legislatively. Again, the life estate is something which already exists in legal practice, but does not exist in the statutes.
Among all the sheaf of papers that I hope that each of you have on the committee, you should have a copy of these amendments. And
They're just passed around,
so you might want to follow along with those as well as the bill itself. And if you identify them, it says Agriculture for Oregon amendments to Senate Bill 237, and then it goes down through
that.
The second change is a rather significant one, and it is the one which changes, well, the first one changes temporary dwelling. We substitute that for mobile home. You'd be surprised the amount of flack we've gotten from the mobile home people by referring to them by name.
For the people in the audience, this, we're talking about the bill, page 6, in the paragraph beginning with line 4, going from line 4 to 9, page 6.
The second part of the change would recognize the facts that in our income test we had not provided for planting perennials. In other words, trees, an orchard or something like that, that would not come into bearing at the time that within the time frame that we're suggesting. So the change that we are putting into the bill simply allows that if you are planting perennials, you meet the income test if at the time of maturity, at the time they come into bearing, they would meet the income test. But for the people in the audience, I simply will read that as it should be, as in our amended form, so they'll know exactly what we're saying. A dwelling in conjunction with farm use on a lot or parcel that is managed as part of a farm unit not smaller than the average farm in the county, producing at least $20,000 in annual gross income, as defined in ORS 308-372, from the crops of livestock to be raised on the farm unit, or that is planted to perennials capable of producing at least $20,000 in annual gross income. That is the significant change there. If the farm operation is smaller than the average farm described in this paragraph, or smaller than 20 acres, whichever is larger, or is not planted to perennials capable of producing at least $20,000 in annual gross income, a temporary dwelling may be allowed. The temporary dwelling may be converted to a permanent dwelling when the farm unit produces at least $20,000 in annual gross income in 2 consecutive years, or when the applicant plants perennials capable of producing at least $20,000 in annual gross sales. Now, you want to explain the philosophy on this?
Do we want to run through all all the changes and then go back and talk about the rationale?
This one is very significant, and we want to devote a little bit of time on how you can get this kind of information and where it's available, so that you've already had some concern from the county planners that they didn't have this kind of information available to them. We think it is, and we'll intend to show you that.
If we run through all these amendments first, I think that might be helpful, and then we want to go back and give you some of the rationale for this part of the bill, which is the most important.
Why don't you do it at the same time, Wallace?
You want to do it at the same time?
Yeah.
Okay. The question has been, why do we require $20,000, and why is there any stipulation like this? This is very much tied in with the fact that as part of what we're presenting tonight, Agriculture for Oregon is recommending that the committee adopt language in this bill that would prohibit non-farm dwellings in agricultural zones. Now, the story is that if you say you can't have a farm dwelling in an agriculture zone, then if you say you can't have a non-farm dwelling in an agriculture zone, then anyone who wishes to have a dwelling will bring it in as a farm dwelling, even if it is a non-farm dwelling. So therefore, we feel that there needs to be some criteria for what a farm dwelling is. And this is an attempt to draft credible criteria which will support and protect commercial agriculture in Oregon. The reason for the $20,000 gross income figure is, instead of, let's say, a $2,500 gross income figure, which has been used for farm definitions in the past many times, simply is that $2,500 does not adequately reflect commercial agriculture. The census figures, the U.S. Census Department does agriculture census figures twice a decade. The latest ones came out in 1978, and I have here a copy, I believe, enough copies for the people who are here, and maybe a few more. The 1978 Census of Agriculture of Linn County, Oregon. This is a kind of material which is available But there is more than this available, and you won't want to take time to look at that in detail now. But it does break it down by farm sizes and farm sizes less than 10 acres and so forth. And we think from the census material, a lot of help can be given to planners as they make decisions and policymakers in counties. The exciting thing is that from the U.S. Census, for a cost of $1,800, information could be obtained by the state, for instance, either by the Soil Conservation Service or by the Department of Land Conservation and Development, which would provide for the whole state information about the size of parcels, let's say the size of farms growing corn or strawberries or hay or wheat, which produce $20,000. In other words, that material is available from the Census Department. It would require the purchase of that census information by a state agency to make it available to counties. We think it would be a credible distinction of what is a commercial farm and what is a non-farm dwelling.
Thank you.
I think that she's covered that really pretty well, but let me simply emphasize again that our reason for going to a test, which is you can sink your teeth into, that you can really identify with, is that we think that as we do away with non-farm dwellings, we're going to have even more problems than we currently have with people claiming to be farmers and are not farmers. And you're going to get additional testimony on that, so I won't dwell on that at this point. The next change we would have would be on page 6, lines 19, and this deals with the area of parks, playgrounds, campgrounds, community centers, and government agencies or nonprofit community organization with hunting and fishing preserves. Essentially, what we're trying to do here is to say that campgrounds should be government-run if they're to be in a EFU zone. In other words, what we're looking at is KOAs. Should they really appropriately be in an exclusive farm use zone? We say no. We allow anything that's government or nonprofit organization oriented, but not campgrounds. We do keep hunting and fishing preserves so that they are a conditional use within an EFU zone and can be privately run as well as government run. And the last change would be on page 7, line 15. And we delete the word vegetation, and that simply is because, I think as I went over this in my original testimony, we feel that vegetation is not a reasonable thing to be considering when you're deciding the criteria under which you make farm or non-farm dwellings allowable. We think that if there are trees there, vegetation, you better take them out if that's the basis of the problem. So our change there, the dwelling is situated upon generally unsuitable land for the production of farm crops or livestock, considering the terrain, adverse soil or land conditions, drainage, and so on. But our change is a lot or parcel shall not be considered unsuitable solely because of its size or location if it can reasonably be put to farm use in conjunction with other land. And this is the Rutherford case, which is already in law. Now I think it's time for us to give, these are the changes. You have those. Are there any questions on the changes before we go to the philosophy
Sir,
of what we're trying to do?
I have one little one. It seemed to me that you would need to have some definition of temporary dwelling.
I certainly will. I think it's already in statute, but I would have to defer to a lawyer to find out. If it isn't, you're right. But we better consider that. Be sure that it's in there somewhere.
Chairman, we sure are getting complaints on that, Jordan, I mean, Hector, about what is temporary and what isn't. That's what Senator Roberts pointed out.
Senator Day, I don't believe you were here when I pointed out the flack we were getting because we used the term mobile home. And so we thought temporary dwelling was better. And we, you know, you can take anything, can be temporary if it can be taken out. And some mobile homes are about as permanent as stick homes. So we are using the term temporary dwelling because it's broader.
Okay.
The guts of our bill really come to page 7, where we talk about the prohibition of non-farm dwellings in Western Oregon. On line, page 7, line 4, when we preface 3A with the phrase in Eastern Oregon, that effectively says that non-farm dwellings may only occur in Eastern Oregon and not in Western Oregon.
We have, of course, the reason for this is that we farmers that are out in the EFU zone find that we have tremendous problems with the folks that move in among us. And you're going to hear from some other people, but I ought to tell you maybe just one little example that happened to me this past summer. I happen to own 50 acres of alfalfa land that's about 3 miles from my home base because it's better land and was able to buy that. It's down a private road about a mile off the county road. And down that road, there is one non-farm dwelling. It happened that some years ago, the farmer that was there built a house there for his daughter. She moved away shortly thereafter, and since that time, that house has been rented. We've had really continuous problems there, but the problem that happened, the renter that happened to be there this time, first he complained about the dust from the gravel road where we hauled our hay by, the alfalfa hay going home. Nothing very serious about that. But I got a call from one of the farmers that lived down that way and said one night at 10 o'clock that there is a car driving around in your alfalfa field. And so naturally we went down to investigate. We went down and found it was this chap who lived right on the road, right there. But instead of walking down to a fishing hole, which is down at the far end of the piece, he had driven through my growing crop. And of course, obviously wherever the tracks of the vehicle were, why the alfalfa could not be harvested. Well, if you harvest it, but you lose it. So it was the kind of problem that you get into that any farmer, I think, would say, well, gee, I won't drive across that fellow's growing crop, but the non-farm people that move out among us do. We think there are a lot of problems. I don't happen to have the problem with dogs because my cattle are penned up. We do have them. I have had them harassing my cattle, but never the way the sheep people do. But we have enough problems out there, and the problem, I guess, that I run into is the one of their complaints from the odor from my dairy operation. And at the time when we pump sprayed the manure on the land, I got a number of complaints, and even some from my farm neighbors, I must admit, as well as from my non-farm neighbors, with the odor that it caused, to the point where I really had to change my system of disposing the manure because of the complaints I was getting, and I wanted to be a good neighbor to them.
Now, we farmers are very grateful to the legislature for your support for us in the past. For instance, I believe it was in the last session that you passed a right to farm legislation to protect farmers like Hector from nuisance suits about his dairy odors. Unfortunately, while the right to farm legislation protects us from that kind of suits, although we're still not sure whether that legislation would stand up very far if it was tested in the courts, that does not protect us from the non-farm neighbor driving on Hector's alfalfa field, or the motorbikes driving in our freshly planted cornfield, or the non-farm neighbor driving through a planted field to dump his garbage in an illegal dump, nor the neighbor children's horses riding on our fields. It protects us from their suits, but it doesn't protect us from their actions, which give us problems. So the Right to Farm Act, while helpful, does not really solve the problem for us of the non-farm intrusions into the agricultural practices of our community.
I just want to interject. I'm going to give you folks about another 10 minutes to cover your presentation. I want to give the other people an opportunity.
Right. So We're just about done.
Okay.
I think.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hurd.
The Hood River question. Have you discussed that with Senator Jernstedt?
I don't know what by the Hood River.
Well,
You're talking about lines 19 and 20 here.
Oh, the fact that they're considered to be part of the ordinance. They are considered. Lois, maybe you know more about that than I do.
To answer your question, we have not talked to Senator Jernstedt, and that's a very good idea, and
I think we should.
We will talk to him, Senator Hurd. Thank you for that suggestion. I believe that it is that Hood River County is frequently considered west of the Cascades land use purposes by the department.
It might be, but when you have things like material discussed in line 4 on that page about single family residential dwellings, you might have an Eastern Oregon thought going through Hood River, and they might not like to be considered west of the mountains. So I think you should talk to Senator Jernstedt.
Thank you. We will
be happy
we
to
will check
that.
I yeah, appreciate that suggestion. Let me just see what this the non farm at the bottom of page 7, lines 36 and 37, you come to another very important part of our proposal, which is that we are proposing that there be no more land divisions for non-farm purposes.
And that's either eastern or western Oregon, or entirely across the state on that one. That really is
the heart.
The heart. I think that's perhaps even more important than the non-farm dwellings in western Oregon. If we can stop the partialization, we pretty well stop the problem. Now, that's not completely true, but it certainly would go a long way just with that one. And we find that there are some counties already that are doing this, so it's not completely new in planning in the state of Oregon.
One of the success stories, I think, of Oregon and land use was revealed in an old Salem Statesman Journal article that I picked up out of my files, an article from December 6th. And I just want to hold up for you this graph, which I think you can see. This relates to the number of Oregon farms. From 1945, this large bar, graph bar, it decreased to 1954 to an all-time low in 1969. Now, the number of farms is increasing from 69 to 1978, at that all-time low of 69. And it seems to me there are two reasons that that's happening. One is that there are smaller farms are occurring, but I think also the important thing is that the legislature in 1969 began to concern itself about preservation of farmland with Senate Bill 10, and I think we are seeing some benefit to the state and some through the improved and strengthened agricultural capability of the state because of land use laws. But we are with a limited resource, and that's why it's important to Agriculture for Oregon that there be no further non-farm divisions in EFU land. Is that it?
I think that's it.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Daryl Gerritsen. And Maggie Collins, did you want to come up together?
I apologize to the committee. My name is Daryl Gerritsen, Yamhill County Council, representing Yamhill County, and with me is Maggie Collins, Senior Planner from Yamhill County. In regard to Section 5, the original bill as written provided, and I think Mr. McPherson's proposed changes at least provide some clarification, but as originally provided, in essence, if a lot was less than 20 acres, regardless of how much it raised under the bill as it was engrossed, regardless of how much it made, you could not place a permanent structure on the property. That is, it provided for a temporary, or at that time a mobile home, by way of a temporary dwelling until you got up to your dollar amount, but the bill itself never said anything about converting it to a permanent structure. So to the extent that Mr. McPherson makes those changes, we'd support those changes. However, we don't support the concept of the dollar amount for the purpose of determining lot size. As I indicated to you Monday, the dollars raised by various crops, the gross income, has a wide swing or a wide variation in our county, from $220 an acre for wheat through $1,700 an acre for grapes on through $5,000 to $20,000 an acre for ornamental horticulture. To take all these, lump them together, and determine what the average farm is in the county and then supplant that for your lot size doesn't take into account the different soil types, different capabilities, and the different type of agriculture. The other concern we have about the income test.
Could
is,
I Senator Roberts? What is the solution?
Yeah, well,
I mean, you criticize this one, but we need to know what. How do you determine what is a farm home?
You can go ahead and use the census.
Did you just put your name on the record?
Oh, excuse me. My name is Maggie Collins.
Thank you very much.
Senior Planner, Yamhill County. You could go ahead and use the census data that Lois was referring to in terms of finding out some average costs per acre of different crops. What Daryl is trying to point, if you wanted to use a figure, what Daryl's trying to point out to you, that every county has a different range, variety of activity of crops that would be grown in exclusive farming zone, and various sizes of farms that are growing them. Most farms are in...
Well, is there some language which could... Sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, go ahead, sir.
Is there some language? That's what we need. You know, we keep getting over and over again, this is wrong, this is wrong, this won't work, but we... It does seem necessary...
To have something that would link up with cost but not make a direct cost, is that what
well,
you're thinking?
Well, or some other way of having some sort of objective measure of what is to be accepted as a farm home and what is not.
To give you some indication of what we do at this time, we require a farm dwelling to provide a farm management plan, and they provide a plan that we review which indicates the type of agriculture they're going to place into production. That falls down, of course, in the fact that we have no enforcement mechanism to go back out there and say, well, you didn't implement the plan. It seems to me that perhaps some language which would provide a mechanism to ensure that there is some sort of productive activity would be the way to go. The problem I have with the dollar figure, especially the $20,000 figure, is if you take an industry in our county like grapes, which is a new industry as far as agriculture goes, the average vineyard is, I think, 11 acres, 12 acres, somewhere in there. They vary between 5 and 20 with some 80-acre vineyards and one 50-acre vineyard that I know of. The bulk of the vineyards are small. Grapes are very expensive to plant. Almost all our grape farmers are part-time farmers. They work out. It's very unlikely that somebody's going to go into grapes in our county on a full-time basis unless they also have the capital to build the winery. The wineries, of course, use their own grapes, plus they buy from the surrounding holdings. The fact that the land is put into production, in my mind, accomplishes the goal without saying that you have to be full-time. If the goal is to have the person participate in the agricultural industry and participate in a meaningful way and raise products and contribute to the agricultural economy, whether they're full or part-time, it's kind of irrelevant. The key is to ensure that the land's put into production. I guess the problem I have with the $20,000 figure is it's, I think, an attempt to try and say you have to be a full-time farmer. Later on, I'm going to present to you some indication of the census data from Yamhill County. I think it's already been presented to the committee.
I think so. Darrell, before you go ahead, if they were looking for language, they could substitute this and maybe say something along this way. Smaller than 20 acres or that the applicant submits some adequate evidence determined by the local governing body that indeed shows that the land will be put into productive commercial use, or if you had to use a cost, use the USDA census figure that they use for all their divisions of calculating farms, which is $2,500. Either way, giving it back to local government, saying, here, you devise a way for your county and your range of agriculture activities to show that those smaller parcels will be contributing to the stream of agricultural activity in the county, or if you have to use a figure, use 2,500, which gets to this point we're saying about part-time, full-time farmers, and the fact that some crops don't have a market some year, sometimes they do. It's not really, we're not really clear that we can always make $20,000, and that cuts your people off that are doing this part-time business right now in the stream of agricultural commerce to change it to a $20,000 figure.
And the reason that's important to Yamhill County is that one of the things the census data noted is Yamhill County had all 11 categories of farms. I mean, we grow everything imaginable in Yamhill County, except hops, I think. We have grapes, filberts, prunes, peaches, wheat, cattle, ornamental horticulture,
exotic birds,
berries. One of the statistics out of the 78 farm census was that 40% of the 1,500 individuals responding described their principal occupation as farming. 60% described their principal occupation as other. Out of the total number, only 28% of the 1,544 responding people had no days of work off the farm, that is, did not work out at all during the year. 48% had 200 days or more that they worked off the farm.
Chairman, I just wanted to...
Senator Roberts?
I would hope that somebody would bring in some alternative language, but I would want to, I would be interested in some assurance that you didn't provide a basis for developing lots or parcels with homes on them under some temporary assertion that they were going to be farmed. And then once it's there, from then on, it could just be a country estate.
One of the potential...
I think that's a problem. That would seem to me to be a problem if you create a parcel which only for one person, under some limited condition, satisfies some sort of a farm criteria, but there is no assurance that it can't immediately be used for some other purpose.
One of the things that's coming up later for discussion, and one of the ways that you do have to ensure that, is presently we have pressure in the EFU zone to develop non-conforming lots, that is, small lots. The reason we have pressure...